the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. In the news these days, you will find the insanity defense. Why? Because there's a raging debate over whether or not it is actually an appropriate plea to offer a criminal defendant. After all, when a person commits a murder or another heinous crime, is it really all that important to know what that individual's state of mind was? And if so, let's just say that it is important and we determine that the person was mentally ill. Does that change the criminality of the act? Does it change the moral judgment of the act? This is not just an abstract, esoteric discussion, because these issues are in the news today, including today's edition of USA Today. It's the right time to talk about it, and talk about it we will on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Now a review of some of the issues in the news after the long Memorial Day holiday. We come back and I face an editorial in my local newspaper here entitled Contraception War. Now, how's that for a little inflammatory rhetoric? The Louisville Courier-Journal editorializing, and I make the fourth paragraph in the editorial. They start out saying, polls show that one of the big issues influencing voters this year is the war in Iraq, but there's another war voters should be concerned about, too, the cultural and religious war centered on, of all things, birth control. Someone please turn on the soundtrack from Wagner, the March of the Valkyries. That's what you're supposed to be hearing when you do this. Religious conservatives marching on contraception. What's next? Back to the editorial. That may seem like a ridiculous statement. Birth control is such a common part of modern life. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that 98% of all American women who have had sexual relations have taken birth control. Yet there is pressure from social conservatives to do away with it, and that pressure is affecting public policy. Now, here's where I come in. As Louisville's own Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, recently told the New York Times, I cannot imagine any development in human history after the fall that has had a greater impact on human beings than the pill. The pill gave incredible license to everything from adultery and affairs to premarital sex and within marriage to separation of the sex act and procreation. End quote. Well, that would make some kind of sense. That is, this contraception war editorial title and the inflammatory rhetoric and bringing me into it. If I had told the New York Times, or anyone else for that matter, that I wanted to outlaw all birth control, all contraception, that's nonsense. That's nowhere implied in the article. You won't find a statement from me on that. I am speaking as a Christian to Christians about what is advisable in biblical, theological, and moral terms. That is a very different conversation than Albert Mohler seeking to influence legislation to ban access to condoms, birth control pills, and all the rest. But that is either completely lost on the editors of this newspaper, or they know better and write this way anyway. Only they know the difference there. I was thrilled in Louisville this past weekend to have the opportunity to speak to the New Attitude Conference. Joshua Harris of Covenant Life Church in Gaithersburg, Maryland, well-known author of books like I Kiss Dating Goodbye, is up to something big with this movement called New Attitude. It was fascinating to be at the convention center with thousands of young adults. You're talking about college students in the main, but young 20-somethings who want the attitude of Christ and who want to have a serious model of Christian discipleship. They understand that this means it will be a countercultural movement. And I was just thrilled to be in their presence. I had the opportunity to lead a session yesterday afternoon on how Christians should deal with issues of sexuality and how we should, armed with a Christian worldview, come to an understanding of issues like homosexuality and transgendered persons and all the rest. And it was just great with them to be able to go back to the very template of the Bible and talk about what our Creator intended in this great and wonderful gift of sex and how, in a sinful world, such a beautiful gift can become so quickly distorted. And we were just engaged in a long exercise yesterday afternoon of about an hour and a half about how to think Christianly about these issues and how to respond with both truth and compassion. And the very conversation we had was so much deeper than what you will find out there in the secular world. But sadly enough, it's also a lot deeper than what you will find in most churches. And that's what I want to say today. I want just to encourage you in your local church, talk about these issues. Go back to the fundamentals. Go back to the biblical text. Try to figure out how Christians should talk and think and decide and act on these things. The theme for the New Attitude Conference this year was delightfully countercultural. The theme was save the wheel. Now, maybe you didn't know that the wheel needed saving, but it's back to the idea that one should reinvent the wheel. And Joshua Harris and his team really came back and said, you know, the last thing we need to do when it comes to Christian truth is reinvent the wheel. We need to save the wheel, and we need to learn about the wheel and appreciate the wheel. Let me just read to you from their website. So what's all the fuss about saving the wheel? SaveTheWheel.com was our tongue-in-cheek attempt at stating the obvious. Certain things shouldn't be reinvented. The wheel is a perfect invention. Its tried and true design has held up for thousands of years. The packaging may have changed, but the concept has stayed the same. Like the wheel, truth never changes. You can't reinvent or improve on truth. This is the wheel, unchanging truth established by God. It's truth that He has established about Himself, His Word, His Church, and His plan for our redemption for His glory. Our role shouldn't be to remake those truths in our own image, but to rediscover and recommit to them. We don't show up and change truth. We let truth change us. Forget reinvention. Embrace a humble orthodoxy. Now, that really is good stuff. I blogged about it at albertmoeller.com overnight. And the very idea of a humble orthodoxy is really important. It is humble because we didn't come up with this. It's humble because it's not something that we, on our own power and authority, have been able to determine. It is humble because it is a truth that was revealed to us. Let me tell you how humble orthodoxy works. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asks his disciples that second question, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus responded by saying, "That's absolutely orthodox. You got the orthodoxy right, Peter." But he went on and he said, "But flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." In other words, yes, that's right. That's orthodox. And boy, is it important to get it right. Truth is, just like the wheel, not something to be reinvented. But at the same time, we must be humble because it isn't something we were smart enough to discover, smart enough to discern, or smart enough to define. It was revealed to us. That's an important issue of the Christian life as well. I also wrote overnight about modesty, because that's a big issue. We've talked about it on this program, and we will talk about it again. And when we do talk about it, boy, do the calls come in, and the emails, and the context. People write in to say, who are you to talk about modesty? Who are you to talk about how women should dress? Who are you to suggest that this is even a serious moral issue? Well, we know it is. Very, very interesting article that appeared in the journal In Character. The title of the article is "Dressing for the Occasion: When is Allure a Fashion Slip?" The author, Pia Catton, makes a very interesting argument. Listen to this. She says, "The relationship between fashion and modesty appears to be straightforward, even immutable. Fashion is the constant enemy of modesty. The former seeks to attract attention, notice, and comment. The latter, by contrast, is the rejection of such theatrics. Modesty in dress is about turning oneself out with consideration for occasion, taste, and economy." Now, modesty in dress has to be a part of a larger context of modesty of spirit, modesty of personality, modesty of presentation, modesty of speech, and all the rest. And Pia Catton is really onto something here. Let me go back to her essay. She says, "It was not always this way. Modest dressing was dealt a blow in the middle of the 20th century, when fashion turned away from the woman and embraced the teenager. The change meant that a respectable look with a suggestion of sexiness gave way to a blatantly sexual look. The easiest way to see this shift is to look at the clothes women wore in the films of the 1940s and the 1950s. In Woman of the Year, that's 1942, Katharine Hepburn plays a brassy newspaper woman who dresses in sharp skirts and tailored jackets. She strides through the newsroom with pride and competence. Is she herself modest? Not really. She is not a wilting flower, and she's definitely not subtle. When Spencer Tracy leaves his hat at her apartment, she sends it back to him in front of everyone in the office in a giant hat box. But while she behaves in bold, attention-getting ways, her character's mode of dress is never loud. In the film, she's a head-turner because of her carriage and attitude, not because her skirt is too short." She goes on to say, "What happened to all that refinement? The Youthquake, the Beatles, Twiggy. From that crucible emerged the miniskirt, one of the least modest pieces of clothing that can still be worn in public. Miniskirts are immodest because they are intended to show off the legs. One has to have the shapely, toned legs of a near adolescent to wear them. They attract the eye almost magnetically, and when worn without tights or stockings, they reveal a lot of skin. I think Pia Catton is onto something, and you will want to read her full essay. A link to it is found at albertmohler.com. Why is this important? It's because the fashion industry, the mannequins, the pictures, the magazines, the catalogs, they are all advertising a blatant sexuality. You know, in reality, if a woman is or a girl is looking for modest clothing, she sometimes has to look outside the mainstream. Or she has to risk looking like she's dressing outside the mainstream. The problem, of course, is where the mainstream is going. The miniskirt now? What's next? We're going to be talking about the insanity defense. Is it insane to think that someone isn't guilty just because they were insane? The phone number is 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Professor Jonathan Turley of the George Washington University is pretty well known. He's on a lot of the Fox and CNN programs. You see him from time to time, especially when there's a big criminal case, big criminal trial going on. Jonathan Turley, in today's edition of USA Today, writes an article entitled Insanity's Legal Fall from Grace. And I've been waiting for a good opportunity to talk about this, and I'm indebted to Professor Turley for just giving us a slow pitch right over home plate. Because the argument he makes, I think, just will not hold water. And I want to tell you what he's up to here. He's up to writing an article in defense of the insanity defense. His concern is that four states, Idaho, Kansas, Montana, and Utah, notice they're all in the West or the Midwest, have eliminated any defense that one is insane. He goes on to say many states, such as Arizona, allow insanity to be used as a defense only when defendants could not understand that their conduct was wrong. Of course, that implies that there would be other applications of the insanity defense in other states. But nonetheless, that's where he is. Four states that do not allow any insanity defense, one state that has severely curtailed the insanity defense. And I want to make an argument here suggesting that the whole idea of the insanity defense is really dangerous. Now, do I believe that there are persons whose mental impairment means that they are not as culpable in terms of committing a crime as others? Yes, that's obvious. In the same sense that developmentally, we don't treat two-year-olds like 40-year-olds. So we do understand there is some development. We understand there are different levels of maturity, different levels of stability, mental stability, and connection with reality. We do understand that. But here's my argument. If an individual murders another individual, it's still murder. I think that an insanity defense, which is not guilty by reason of insanity, is itself a legal fiction that creates a gross moral error. Because I think the person did commit the murder. If we know the person killed another person, he is a murderer. So far as I'm concerned, the issue of mental stability, mental state, insanity, developmental issues, and all the rest should not come in at the plea stage, nor at the conviction stage, but if the person actually did the crime, at the stage of sentencing. In other words, I would want to leave the court some room to say this person actually committed this murder. It was a murder. It was, by an objective standard, a wrong, evil, and sinful act. It was, by the standard of the law, an illegal and criminal act. There may, however, be circumstances that would lead us to believe that this punishment would be more appropriate, or this treatment would be more appropriate than what we might do in the case of someone who committed a similar crime with a different state of mind. Now, what frustrates me is when I read an article like Insanity's Legal Fall from Grace in today's USA Today, it's put in moral terms as if society owes persons the right to be found not guilty when we know they are guilty. As a matter of fact, Jonathan Turley ends his argument by saying, from a defense, even so, just as religion teaches us that we must obey the command of the Almighty, even in killing a child, the law must recognize that troubled persons may be acting under the delusion of such orders. When states fail to recognize the difference between a premeditated and a delusional act, they commit an act every bit as immoral as disobeying the command of God. That, I would submit, is absolute nonsense. I could dress it up and call it hyperbole and exaggeration, but I think it's worse than that. I think it's moralistic nonsense. I think those states that have removed an insanity defense are just reflecting citizen outrage at some of the notorious cases. In the United States, almost surely the most notorious case is that of John Hinckley, who beyond a shadow of a doubt actually attempted the assassination of President Ronald Reagan. And as you know, he's now been allowed to go home with his family. And he was found not guilty by reason of insanity and has been in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in the metropolitan D.C. area for some time. There are other very similar cases, mothers who've killed their children, husbands who've killed their wives, all kinds of awful crimes that have been committed. The insanity defense has roots going all the way back in prehistory. And I say prehistory, I mean the time before Christ. We're talking about B.C., where even the ancient Greeks and Romans had some idea that mental state was important here. We understand that. Any civilized party recognizes that there are developmental stages and there are mental impairments. But I come back to my argument that the plea stage and the conviction stage are the wrong stages for that to be important. It's important in the sentencing phase. When the state says, yes, this person did commit this act, now what are we going to do about it? That's very different. In the 19th century, there was an attempt upon the life of a British prime minister, and that's where a lot of this comes from, just in terms of the history of the insanity defense. And that particular issue came down. It was in 1843, the case of Daniel McNaughton, and the idea of an insanity defense in the Victorian era came down, and the judges of the common law courts decided that McNaughton should not have been acquitted of the crime just because someone said he was guilty, insane. Rather, there should be a formal process of determining whether a person's insane. Now, here's the other big issue for us. Let's assume that someone wants to argue against my position. Someone wants to argue, no, an insanity plea is appropriate. Okay, then, define insane. Because there are some crimes that I think one could safely argue could only be committed by an insane person. At least by my lay definition of insanity. But that's the kind of definition that's being used by defense attorneys all over America, except in the four states aforementioned. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What do you think about the insanity defense? This is the right time to talk about it, because right now it's becoming an issue of concern in many state legislatures. And I think it ought to be a concern to anyone who would try to think seriously about crime and punishment. For Christians, this is a very important issue, because our responsibility is to understand, first of all, the objectivity of right and wrong. Murder is simply wrong, not because we feel it to be wrong or because we hope it to be wrong, but because it is wrong, because God has determined that it's wrong. So is it then wrong to say that someone is not guilty when we know they are? The phone number, 877-893-TALK, 877-893-8255. We're going to go to Nancy, listening on XM Radio, calling from Newport News, Virginia. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Mueller? I wanted to say that I think people should be put to death for murder, and even if they're insane, that doesn't have anything to do with it, because I would kill someone and not be insane and claim that I was insane to get out of, like, the death penalty, right, or to be in prison for the rest of my life. And if you truly are insane, all the more reason. If you don't know what you're doing, you could kill, like, every 10 minutes of every day. So that's all the more reason to put you away.
Okay, Nancy, let me press you on a couple of questions here as we're trying to think this together. First of all, what if the person is mentally ill and needs treatment rather than punishment?
I'm sorry, but if a member of my family was killed by someone who's insane, like the John Hinckley thing, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I believe his family doesn't live far from me. I think they're in Williamsburg, Virginia. And when I read in the paper that he was going to go home and visit his family, I'm like, what? You've got to be kidding me. I couldn't believe it. This guy tried to kill the President of the United States, and he gets to go visit his family?
Yeah, Nancy, I feel your concern and outrage there, and by the way, I share it. I think this is one of those clarion cases that demonstrates why the insanity defense is itself so morally suspect. And I appreciate you sharing that personal anecdote. I had the feeling that behind your passion there was something very, very important to you. Nancy's given us something to think about. The whole question of the insanity defense is one that requires some very careful Christian thinking, and the time is now. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Our task and challenge is intelligent Christian conversation. Call and help us think it out.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The issue here is moral culpability in criminal cases where the insanity defense is increasingly being used. And you have some states that are trying to regulate this, minimize it. Four states that have now completely outlawed an insanity defense. My argument is that the whole idea of an insanity defense is a legal fiction. It's a dodge of the moral issue. If the person murdered another person, just for example, it was murder. And I think the person needs to be convicted of murder just based upon the evidence. There needs to be the moral judgment that this was murder. Then the question becomes what to do with this person. And I think at that stage you can bring in all kinds of issues, from developmental questions to insanity and mental illness and all the rest. But I think the wrong way to do it is to have an insanity defense. And I think increasingly states are becoming frustrated with this. Citizens are becoming frustrated. Just take one example here. LaShawn Harris, the Oakland, California woman who threw her three children into the bay from a San Francisco pier last October. She has been ordered to stand trial for the killings despite testimony that she is mentally ill. That's led to a lot of controversy. But the state of California, I mean, we're talking about the state of California, okay? We're talking about blue state here. The state of California says it is important that we determine if these were murders and if she did it. And I think that's right. After that, we can make some other determinations. But I think to avoid a criminal conviction for a clearly criminal act just insults the objectivity of the law and the objectivity of the moral status of committing a heinous crime like murder. But I want to know what you think. Let's think it through together. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I mean, at one level, this is sort of like what every parent has to deal with children at different developmental stages, different stages of moral consciousness. We do not treat a 2-year-old like a 12-year-old or a 12-year-old like an 18-year-old. But that doesn't mean that it's any less guilty and any less morally significant to lie at age 2 than at age 12. Let's go to James calling from Charleston, South Carolina, listening on XM170. Go ahead, James.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Mohler?
Glad to hear from you, James. Good, good. Go right ahead.
I was listening in and earlier to one of the callers.
Yes.
And I agree with you that first you have to determine that it was actually murder. But the case of, say, a person who doesn't know or realize what they've actually done, or either can determine the difference between whether what they're doing is right or wrong, they haven't really committed murder. Because murder, in my opinion, is something where you know that you're doing something wrong, but you intentionally do it anyway, and you kill the person. So that would be my conflict as to whether or not that person should be punished.
Yeah.
The way a person would be punished if it was determined, like you just said in your following statement, that it was actually wrong to kill that person.
Okay, James, I really appreciate the thought you put into this. Let me come back and say, at what point do you think a person can be judged not to know the difference between right and wrong, good and evil? In other words, what are you looking for there? I think that's a question a lot of citizens have, because they just want to know, how in the world does this come down? I mean, there are persons who have warped understandings of right and wrong. There are people that are perhaps even mentally retarded. That's another question. That are mentally incapacitated and have diminished mental capacities. There are all kinds of language, all kinds of terms that are applied here. But what about paranoid schizophrenia or something like that? In other words, are you looking for a clinical diagnosis, or how do you think we know this?
Well, I think it's going to boil down to a jury listening to the facts, listening to evidence, and reviewing that evidence, and coming down to a consensus. Because, I mean, I don't necessarily say that there's a particular clinical, I guess, reasoning behind or determination of whether or not it's murder or I don't know, how would you say it?
Yeah, I don't know myself. Yeah, I appreciate your call, James. I think part of the difficulty here, again, is in the definitions. For instance, some states allow a plea or a finding entitled guilty but mentally ill. Others include standards about diminished capacity. But, you know, the one thing that is kind of entered into this discussion now is the difference between, say, a doctor or a psychiatrist or psychologist making this determination, or a grand jury or a judge or a jury. I do not know of many circumstances in which a jury actually gets to decide that question. At least, as it's explained usually, that determination is made before the plea is entered. The plea of not guilty is what generally leads to most criminal trials. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We've obviously hit something important here, because this really gets down to the intersection of the questions of right and wrong, good and evil, and human moral responsibility. We live in an age that increasingly wants to let all of us off the hook, not just those who have some kind of claim for mental illness or diminished capacity, but they want all of us to feel just a little less guilty. We'll be right back. Looking at the facts of the case, there are some persons who think that John Hinckley got exactly what he deserved. In other words, since he seemed to think that somehow Jodie Foster would be impressed by his attempt to assassinate President Ronald Reagan, that he would somehow win her heart, and that delusion, real or unreal, I have no clue. I can't read John Hinckley's mind, and I really doubt the ability of many others to read his mind, to tell you the truth. Nonetheless, that argument was enough to constitute an insanity defense, and thus he is not a convicted attempted murderer. Rather, he is a ward of the state for mental health reasons, and now able even to visit with his family on weekends and do some other things. Something that presumably would not be the case if this person were found guilty of attempting to assassinate a president of the United States. And then there are all these other cases where mothers have killed their children, and spouses have killed each other, and children have killed their parents, and you just go down this long list. And the insanity defense is increasingly being used in order to say, look, this person really isn't morally responsible. I think that's a dodge. I think it's the wrong place to do it. I've made my argument. Now you make yours. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Seth, listening on WFIA, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Seth.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I'm glad you're attacking this issue. It's one of many that plague our judicial system. I'll be terse and hang up. I think that this rhetoric needs to be challenged prior to getting to the courts, and we can wipe that out by letting courts do the legal business. I think the jury and the court's just there to establish whether or not the individual committed the crime, to use your example, murder. Did they commit that crime? And then that's it. If the defense wants to use an insanity plea, that's fine. That should just be something that hangs on the side of the record to be determined after the ruling by another board, a medical board with a specific screening exercise, one that will satisfy sanity or not. Thank you.
Yeah, Seth, I think that is a very clear argument, and it's very similar to the argument that I would make, that the plea stage is the wrong place to enter the issue of diminished moral capacity or mental illness or anything else of a similar nature. I just don't think the insanity defense works morally. It may work legally, in the eyes of some, because it allows some persons to be recognized as having less capacity than others. But I don't think it works morally, because I think it confuses the issue of the objectivity of the evil act. And in this case, speaking most clearly of murder, I think it's the thing we can most clearly understand. This person at least had the ability to premeditate this murder, had the ability to seize the opportunity to use a weapon, to do whatever. The question beyond that isn't whether this person did this rightly or wrongly. That's nonsense. The question is, committing this awful act, are there mitigating circumstances that we should take into account when it comes to sentencing? And I think there often would be. Let me just give you another example, because this one is perhaps a little more difficult. It's not just an insanity defense. It also has to do with the time, with the issue of development. I mean, after all, we don't execute 4-year-olds. We don't even execute 14-year-olds. A 14-year-old could commit murder, but we don't execute him or her. And the reason is that we understand there are developmental stages. And, I don't have a doubt in my mind that a 14-year-old can be fully culpable of such an awful crime. But again, as a society, I think most would feel very uncomfortable with executing a young teenager. I don't think that's going to happen. It didn't in times fairly recently for crimes less than murder. in Victorian England until there was a change in the law. You could be executed for all kinds of things, even as a child. And I think most of us would agree that's some kind of moral progress. But I don't think it's moral progress when we confuse the issue by throwing in this vague category of an insanity defense, which then leads to a plea that is something other, in most cases, than guilty. And I think that's why a lot of Americans would applaud the four states that have decided to outlaw the insanity defense. Again, those four states being Idaho, Kansas, Montana, and Utah, and other states as well that are trying to constrain and redefine this defense and its application. Thanks for your call, Seth. Let's go to Alan from Big Stone Gap, Virginia. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes, Dr. Muller. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear from you.
Enjoy your program. I think you're right online because of sin, we know why murder's in the world. And unfortunately, that brought in, you know, retardation and so-called insanity. I think you're right that people are going to have to be punished, and I don't think that it should be an issue. We just need to get rid of the insanity of plea. And I think a problem that you'll find is whether state or federal, is anybody going to be able to come up with a baseline that says what a person is when they're insane?
Yeah, I think that, again, is an issue of citizen frustration and of Christian concern. I think the definitions here. In this therapeutic age, there are any number of persons who are ready to define all of us as somehow mentally ill. You take the current DSMN of, you know, the statistical manual of mental diseases, and, you know, one of the things you'll discover is that just about everybody is covered by something in there. And I think there are clever attorneys and clever psychologists who could come up with a claim that almost anyone's insane. That's not to deny that there are persons who obviously are suffering from incredible mental illnesses and from very clear mental incapacity. So the devil is in the details and in the definitions here. But I think a society that intentionally blurs the question of the objectivity of evil when it comes to the objectivity of a crime like murder, I think that's a society that's really made a pact with nonsense that begins to erode the moral credibility of the entire justice system. Jonathan Turley, writing in USA Today today, argues that the states that outlaw the insanity defense are themselves immoral because a moral society, he implies, should have something like an insanity defense. Well, I would argue that a moral society needs to have something like a sentencing process that would include not only penal punishments, that's kind of a redundancy, but, you know, punishments having to do with time or with other state-mandated allowable constitutional punishments, but should also have the option to get persons help. These are not easy or simple questions. I recognize this. Let's go very quickly to Charlie Kahn from Woodstock, Virginia. Go ahead, Charlie.
Dr. Muller, my thing is with the insanity plea is how many people are contemplating murder already thinking of claiming insanity.
Oh, Charlie, boy, you're onto something there. As a matter of fact, some of the great crime writers have told stories about how persons have planted the evidence of their own insanity prior to premeditating a murder they carry out. And that's not just in fiction, that's in real life, too. Again, that's not to say that it's never the case that someone genuinely has a deep and troubling mental illness that ought to be a part of our legal consideration. I just argue it shouldn't be at the question of the defense plea. It shouldn't come in the form of not guilty by reason of insanity. It's the not guilty part that I just don't believe is true. I'll be right back. This is the kind of conversation we need to have as Christians, thinking about a serious issue and trying to take it apart in moral terms. Where do we start? That's always a good question. When we are thinking about something like an insanity defense, do we start with the law? Well, yes, in one sense. I would suggest that as Christians, we have to start with the law of God. And that reminds us that God, the lawgiver, gives us the law as an objective reality. It is the objectivity of the law that demonstrates why a lie is a lie, why stealing is wrong, why disobeying parents is wrong, etc. In other words, there are very clear objective standards that are set down. We need that. And if we think about it, we know we need it. But the second issue that really comes into play here is the determination that a legal system, a criminal system for a nation, has to maintain some credibility on matters of good and evil, right and wrong, guilt and innocence. And when we begin to fray the edges of that question, we really begin to undermine the credibility of the system and rule of law. One of the ways that we begin to undermine this is by suggesting that there's kind of guilty and not guilty at the same time. And I think that's nonsense. You know, if one commits the crime, one's guilty of the crime. What people often mean by that is there are mitigating circumstances. It might have to do with diminished mental capacity, might have to do with any number of issues that should be taken into account. Yes, I agree. I understand that. That's why we don't execute children. And we do understand there are developmental issues and any number of other issues that come into play there. But in our times, we have this therapeutic revolution that has so warped the way we think about things that we now assume that anyone who commits, say, crime X or Y must be insane because crime X or Y requires insanity. Well, this is where the Christian has to come in and say sin requires a certain level of insanity. I mean, the very act of defying a holy God requires a certain level of what could be rightly called insanity. It is irrational. It is simply wrong. And yet it's our story. When Christians look at the law, we have to think not only of what works, that's the simple test of pragmatism and experience, we have to think about what is right. And when we ask the question about what is right, we have to go a little deeper than seeing, well, you can bring in this argument and this specialist and that specialist and this doctor and this attorney and this judge and come up with a way to say what we know isn't true. And that is that the person is actually not guilty by reason of insanity. I think it's the not guilty part that's the problem. Guilty. Perhaps also suffering from a severe mental illness of some form or delusion or diminished mental capacity. I just don't think it helps to say not guilty. Tomorrow's Ask Anything Wednesday. You'll get to set the agenda. I'll join you tomorrow for intelligent conversation. We'll find out what's on your mind. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.